We're looking at the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, about down to the fourth verse or so. I appreciate everybody being here with us tonight and hope that just jumping into it is all right. Many of you were here with us last night and saw how we got to this place. So I'll just start in, and if we need to go back for any background, we can. But in verse 4 of Revelation chapter 12, we see that the tail of the dragon swept a third part of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. At the time that this is speaking of, the Roman Empire was divided into three parts. There was Europe, and then there was the East, and then there was Africa. So a western part, an eastern part, and a southern part at this particular time in the history of the empire. And in this early 4th century, there were five or six men contending for the supremacy in the Roman Empire. And I started to talk about this last night, and we ran out of time. I want to be as succinct as I can about this while still showing what I believe the fulfillment is of this time. So bear with me on this. This is not fun for any of us. Don't think that you're the only one that's bored with this material, because I'm not particularly fond of it either, but I think we have to get into enough detail to see the fulfillment. So here we go on this, and ahead of time I ask for your forgiveness. Constantine and Licinius were ruling Britain, Gaul, and Spain, as well as much of North Africa and Italy. Galerius, who had been the main henchman of Diocletian, was ruling the eastern part, the eastern third, Syria, Egypt, and Asia Minor. The persecutions of the fifth seal that we've talked about previously were happening at this time. The sorrow as of a woman in travail, as it's put here in chapter 12. The first edict of toleration was on April the 13th, 311 A.D. This gave official imperial recognition to Christianity for a while, because Constantine did it, but he didn't have total control yet. So it ended the pagan persecution for a while. And then we get into the fine print of what was going on here. When Galerius died the following month, in the month of May, he was succeeded as the Eastern Emperor by Maximum. Maximum resumed the persecution and deprived the church in his third of the empire of their newfound imperial status. I think that's the way that the dragon's tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth, because in that third of the empire, the church became persecuted again. Now, we've spoken in the past, when we looked at chapter 6, the end part of chapter 6, we've talked about Constantine's very famous battle of Mulvian Bridge, just north of Rome, on October 28, 312 A.D., This was the one where the night before he supposedly saw the sign of the cross in the sky and heard a voice saying to him, "In this sign conquer," and he went out and put the cross on his ensigns and won the battle the next day. So he supposedly attributed the victory to the Lord, and that's why he later made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire. Anyway, as the war between the rival emperors continued, Licinius beat Maximum on April the 30th, 313. Licinius became emperor in the east and for a time restored there the status of Christianity. The Milan Edict of Toleration gave Christians freedom that I believe ended the birth pangs there, freedom to worship and practice their faith, ending these severe birth pangs which had been so intense under Diocletian and Galerius for 8 years with their attempt to eradicate Christianity from 303 to 311 AD. Subsequently, Licinius himself apostatized and renewed persecution against the Eastern churches. The dragon stood before the church, eager to swallow up the child that she travailed with, because he could see that, as the world looked at it, the devil looked at it the same way, that this was an advancement for Christianity. We've got to remember that the devil is not omniscient. The devil doesn't know, not only doesn't he know the future, but he doesn't even know everything about what's happening right now. The devil is not the opposite of God. God is omniscient and omnipotent, all-knowing, all-wise. But the devil is limited. The devil is a created being. He is a lot smarter than we are, but he doesn't know everything. This is why he allowed Jesus to be crucified. He actually was operative in getting Jesus to be crucified, not realizing that when he did that, that the blood of Jesus would make possible the salvation of all of us and the existence of the church, and then the resurrection turned everything around. If the devil had known that was going to happen, he wouldn't have had Jesus crucified in the first place. But he made a big mistake there, and he's making the same kind of an error here. He's getting ready to swallow up the man-child when really he's going to figure out subsequently that this man-child is going to be his best friend. And I hope to develop that as we go along. Constantine transferred the authoritarian concept of government that had been established for the empire by Diocletian just right before this time, as we talked about last night. He took that concept of government that Diocletian had made for the Roman Empire, and Constantine applied it to the church. He applied it to the whole church that was under his authority. So upon the birth of the male child, we had this new state church. I think that's what the male child is. The new state church under Constantine in a so-called Christian Roman Empire. This was caught up to the heaven of imperial power and authority. The Christianity that was elevated under Constantine was a Catholic hierarchical Christianity made to be the religion of the state. Wherever you have church-state religion, you don't have the Christian faith as we're told about in the Bible. They cannot function together. But that's what they were trying to do. The Christianity elevated under Constantine was a state church to rule the nations with a rod of iron, as it's said here, exercising power in league with the ten horns or kings during the 1260 years. The war in heaven between Michael and the dragon and their angels had its counterpart with the competing emperors and generals of the empire. Remember back in the book of Daniel, you have the prince of Greece and the prince of Persia that are actually demonic beings. They're actually demons, but they're communicating with each other. One of them needed help from the other and said, come on over here and help me. But they were unseen angels and demonic forces that were involved in the destinies of the nations. Another time, Elisha just was able to pull back the curtain for a moment and show somebody the true fighting forces, the angelic fighting forces, which normally are unseen when the nations of the world are fighting each other. There are angels, there are demons behind these things. We don't fully understand that because we're not told very much about it in the Bible. Well, I think we have the same thing here. Michael, the dragon, they're angels, they're fighting, but it's being played out on earth by the armies and governments of men. It's just a little glimpse behind the veil here that we're allowed. Constantine, under the banner of the cross, is fighting against the pagan forces. Diocletian became ill. He abdicated his throne, as I think I said to you when we studied the sixth chapter, that he went to growing cabbages, and somebody said, why did you abdicate the throne? And he held up a couple cabbages and said, when you can grow cabbages like these, why would you want to be emperor? But he really was pretty ill at that time and may have even committed suicide a little later. Galerius died of a loathsome disease. Maxentius was killed in the Battle of the Mulvian Bridge. Maximum was defeated by Licinius and died in the summer of 313. Licinius disputed the state of Illyricum, which was kind of in the middle of the empire, a territory that was claimed by Constantine between the Eastern and Western empires. Constantine went to battle to reclaim or to retain Illyricum, and he won. And Licinius, after yet another rebellion, was put to death in 325. And this is how Constantine gained the supremacy over the entire Roman Empire. And I think it's how the great red dragon was hurled down. It's a remarkable thing how the Christian government went over to Constantinople right away, as if it just couldn't stand to stay there in Rome. Immediately after its formation, it forsook the seven hills of Rome for another seat and another throne, as if Rome were a spot with which it could just not be associated. And the Christian government went over to Constantinople after the division of the empire. The Western emperors did not make their capital at Rome. They made it first at Milan, and then later under Honorius it was made at Ravenna, but not at Rome for quite a long time here. Satan lost the means of imperial Rome. which he had been using to wage his frontal attack against the church through all the years of pagan persecution. We've looked at a list of 10 pagan Roman persecutions through the years under the fifth seal. But Rome herself then, as we saw in chapter 8, was struck down by the Gothic barbarian conquerors, her head, as it were, wounded unto death, as it's put in chapter 13. The deliverance from the persecuting power of pagan Rome enabled the church to freely proclaim the gospel. But the choir that we've seen singing here also warns of woes to come, for they said the devil is angry because he knows that his time is short. Again, the devil's not omniscient. He didn't know time was going to stretch out like it has either. The devil doesn't know any more about the timing of the judgment day than we do. That comes as a surprise to a lot of people for some reason. But he doesn't. He doesn't know a lot of things. We should not assume that he knows everything that God knows. He didn't know just how long he had, but he knew that paganism had had its day. And that was a real problem for him because he'd been working through pagan emperors to persecute the church. So now he's going to figure out, with the brilliance that he possesses, given to him by God, he's going to figure out that he can transform himself into an angel of light and he can use the Roman Empire again in a more subtle way. The woman represents the true visible church, as we said last night. The male child is caught up to heaven, but the woman is not. And this is a very important point. The state church is exalted by the government of man, but the woman, the true visible church, is not. And it's of a very different character. The newly born state church is very different from the woman and becomes more different as time goes by. It's very different from the woman from whom it was born. Constantine produced a complete change in most people's general idea of what it meant to be a Christian at that time. The restraint which resulted from the persecuting power was taken away. During the early centuries, persecution had a lot to do with keeping the church free from hypocritical members. You weren't going to be a part of the church unless you really meant it because you knew it could cost you your life. But now, heathen symbols start disappearing from the coins. On Constantine's medals, the cross was erected over the figure of a fallen dragon, which is interesting in light of the representation by the symbols in this chapter. Constantine's cross was erected over a fallen dragon on a number of his medals. Churches were endowed with money from the state. Magnificent meeting houses were erected. Riches and honors were heaped upon the clergy. The government of the church was reorganized after the model of the state. No longer were you going to have the kind of government that the New Testament talks about. The status and authority of the bishops was greatly enhanced. A pompous ritual was established in the place of the simple worship in spirit and in truth. Candidates for baptism began presenting themselves in droves to get in on what the new popular thing. Many of them motivated, of course, by worldly desires. Unguarded language was used in ascribing this victory to the martyrs who had gone on before. And this prepared the way for the undue veneration and then even worship of the martyrs. And the substitution of the martyrs' supposed mediatorship and guardianship for the sole mediatorship of Christ. And this has gone a long way. We know we've got it all around us. We all know people who pray to saints. Recently, I heard of a girl, the death of a girl who obviously was a woman in her 60s now, but I went to high school with her, and she was a girl when I knew her, a very sweet girl in high school. Recently, she died of cancer, and I was shown her last prayer to St. Jude. It just makes you sick. It's almost enough to make you cry that people are so misled in this way. Was St. Jude crucified for you? That's what Paul would have asked about that. Constantine took to himself the title of bishop and exercised authority over the external affairs of the church. In the wake of the Arian controversy, and we've talked about this before, I think, the Arians believed that Jesus Christ was a created being, and their doctrine began to sweep through various parts of the empire. In the wake of that, Constantine even required the death penalty, not only for pagan idolaters, but also for Christian dissidents. So it seems like no matter who has power here, they start persecuting those who are different from them. During the early church, the Christians under persecution had been driven to the simplicity of the gospel. Persecution had a purifying effect on the church. With the state-sponsored church in the 4th century, there was not only an influx of nominally converted pagans, there was also a tendency among most of the people in the church toward a formal externalism, exhibited especially by the newly exalted bishops. They paganized Christianity in order to christen paganism. It was like a compromise. It was like a mixture, an amalgamation of Old Testament Hebrew worship and pagan worship along with elements of Christian worship. It was a mixed brew. And so by degrees, a great gulf grew between the male child, the Church of Rome, which doesn't have a pope yet, but a great gulf grew between that male child and the woman, the true visible church. And thus she was given, as we see later in the chapter, she was given two wings of an eagle that she might fly into the wilderness. And this occurs by degrees in the chapter. First she flees, and then she flies. She flees on her feet, and then she flies with the eagle wings that were given to her. But, and this is, I think, a very important point for us to remember, the 1260 days of her sojourn in the wilderness do not begin until she is actually there. So we got to let her get there, and it takes centuries for her to get there. First she flees, and then she flies, but it's a very gradual transition from the fall of paganism to the rise of the papal power. And even then, this woman is only hidden. She is not lost. She gradually vanished in her distinctive features from public view. Public worship lost its scriptural character and lost its simplicity. To illustrate this, just imagine for a moment that in the time of Diocletian, early in the 4th century, you go throughout the Roman Empire, various portions of it, and you visit congregation after congregation after congregation in the various provinces of the empire. What do you see? What do you hear? Well, you're going to see and hear things that would be a lot like what we saw and hear and heard here on Sunday morning. You're going to see of God's Word read and expounded by saints that are worshiping God in spirit and in truth. But after a couple centuries have passed, you go back to those same congregations in various portions of the empire. What are you going to see and what are you going to hear then? In almost all of them, you're going to find a pompous ritual. You're going to see rich vestments. You're going to smell incense burning. You're going to see candles and bowings and prostrations, all kinds of ceremony. You know, God gave His church very little ceremony. What ceremony did He give the church? We have baptism in water. We have the Lord's Supper. We have the laying on of hands and the appointing of officers. What more ceremony do we have in the church? God was not that interested in ceremony. But you're going to see all kinds of ceremony in these same congregations that didn't have it a couple hundred years ago. And you're going to have little, if any, of the Word of God read or explained. What's happening? The woman is gradually disappearing from sight. She's fleeing and then flying into the wilderness. She's fleeing toward the wilderness. Her seed continued to exist, but the woman herself, their mother, is disappearing from view. She found herself a wanderer. She found herself persecuted and suffering. But in the wilderness, she continued to bring forth seed, to bring forth more sons and daughters. And at the end of the time, times, and half a time, then she comes forth again. Remember, the Reformation that we mentioned last night in chapter 11 was an advance out of the wilderness state, but it was not the complete emergence from the wilderness state by any means. The witnesses were still in sackcloth, and the church was still in the wilderness. Now, what about the flood out of the mouth of the serpent? The flood out of the serpent's mouth indicates a satanic attempt to destroy the church by deception and by false teaching. What flows from the mouth is teaching. This is fulfilled, I believe, by the intrusion of Arianism into the empire, which we've talked about before. After the defeat of Arianism at the Council of Nicaea under Constantine in 325 AD, it still tended to dominate in the Eastern Church, and with the establishment of an Arian emperor in the person of Constantius, who was Constantine's own son, it came to prevail in the Western Church as well. Constantius ruled in the East from 337 to 353, and then as sole emperor from 353 till his death in 361. Just after that, in 363, Julian the Apostate made an attempt to restore paganism, if you can believe that. Here we'd had thousands of years of paganism, finally got rid of it, but now we've got an emperor who wants to bring it all back. He was not successful in doing that. He couldn't get any traction for paganism at all because paganism as a system was spiritually dead. Everybody knew it except Julian the Apostate. Well, a bunch of converts tried to come to it when the emperor was trying to sell it, but mostly from hope of getting political offices by seeming to agree with the emperor. Julian the Apostate even gave orders to rebuild the Jerusalem temple in Jerusalem. But this is very, very interesting to me, and I'm not sure I understand it completely. They started in to rebuild the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, but when the workmen began to dig the foundation, balls of fire came out of the ground and burnt several workmen to death. Well, they didn't know what to think about that. So after they rebounded from this, the surviving workers tried again, and the same thing happened again, possibly due to explosions from natural gas hitting a stone against hitting a blade against a stone as you're digging and then igniting natural gas that was underground. But the main explanation that was given at the time was that this was divine intervention and we're not supposed to be rebuilding this temple. So after repeated scorchings, they gave up and the Jewish temple never was rebuilt. Julian the Apostate only reigned for a year and a half, and his death was viewed as the final downfall of paganism. Just before his death, as dramatized by the poet Swinburne, Julian is purported to have said, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean." As the 4th century progressed, there was an influx of barbarian people into the empire, and they were almost all Arians, almost to a person. They were Arians. I think this is the floodwaters. A little later in chapter 17, verse 15, we see that the waters there, the waters on which the harlot rider of the beast was to sit, were people. They represented people. And I think that's true of the water here. This flood is the people coming in. After the death of Constantius, we have the Emperor Valens from 364 to 378 continuing to vigorously promote this Arian doctrine, and it remained for Theodosius I, who was probably the most powerful emperor between Constantine and Charlemagne. He was emperor clear up to 395. He took actions that officially purged the empire from Arianism. All toleration for paganism was put to an end by him as well. But Arianism continued among the barbarians who invaded the empire well into the 6th century. When we see there that the earth helped the woman, I think the meaning of this is that since the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river from the dragon's mouth, there was an absorption of the invading barbarian flood into the old settled Roman population. In other words, when all these hordes of barbarians came in, they streamed in like a flood, like a river, but they settled down like water that wasn't moving anymore. They just became a part of the landscape along with everybody else. Not only were much of their original institutions and customs and their languages absorbed, but their religion was absorbed as well. The barbarians were converted, at least nominally, to the Christian faith. Instead of barbaric paganism or Arianism, now the Christian Trinitarian creed was at last universally adopted. So the Arianism and paganism of this flood was absorbed into the soil of the empire and disappeared. John saw that the dragon was enraged by his defeat, and he went off to make war with the rest of the woman's offspring, which is a very interesting statement, I think, with the remnant of her seed, the rest of her offspring, who are described as those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Very interesting to me that the woman has other seed besides just the man-child. And I think we have an issue of wheat and tares here. It's a distinction between the wheat and the tares, or darnel, as the tares are sometimes called. Darnel is an eastern weed that mimics wheat until it ripens. When it ripens, it turns gray instead of the golden color of wheat. So when it finally ripens, then you can figure out which is which. Prior to that time, you can't really tell. But darnel is poisonous and cannot be milled with the wheat. So Jesus taught, as you well know, that both must be left to grow together until the harvest, at which time they will be separated. There are always going to be professing Christians who will not fare well when the judgment day comes. So the dragon goes off to make war against the faithful church. Chapter 12 leaves this effort of the dragon unexplored, but it is addressed in chapter 13. To make war with the remnant of her seed, the dragon evokes a beast from the sea and gives him his power. This beast makes war with the saints. So that's probably enough on chapter 12, if not too much. Anybody want to say something on chapter 12 before we proceed to 13? Okay, 13 goes right on. These divisions are just placed there by man to make, I guess, easy pieces of Scripture to read. I think just to get it in front of our minds, probably we should take the time to read chapter 13 and then go right on talking about it, because there's no real break here in the original text. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the names of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? And who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies. And power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given unto him over kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and should cause that as many as them as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. All right, the dragon comes down to stand, and what I read to you was from the 1769 King James Version of the Bible. Some of you that have text translated from some other manuscripts will have a little different rendering in a place or two. The dragon comes to stand on the shore of the sea as if in anticipation of the arrival of his accomplice. John saw the beast rising up out of the sea. This beast rose gradually from the sea, perverting Scripture and perverting historical facts, rewriting history to make it read a different way. There was an incipient development, and then there was a fuller unfolding afterward, just as there was with the ten horns becoming the ten kingdoms. The things we're talking about take centuries to come to fruition. Now, the sea was commonly regarded as the habitat of evil deities by the people of those days, in the time that John was writing this. In chapter 11, we saw that the beast came out of the abyss, and here we're told that it came from the sea. The abyss is deeper than the sea and is beneath the sea. This persecuting power, as far as was visible to man, rose out of the sea of people, the Gothic inundation, a sea of anarchy and confusion. The waters are people, Revelation 17, 15. But they're no longer people in motion, as has been symbolized by the river flowing from the dragon's mouth with their false doctrine of Arianism. Now they're waters that have stopped. God's eye could see that this really, though, before coming up out of the sea, came from the deeper depth of hell under the sea. John saw it coming up from the sea in the depiction that he was given. The angel described it in chapter 11 as coming up from the abyss. And we have seen previously that any marine volcanic island rises both from the sea but also from a deeper depth beneath the sea. And that's the idea here. It comes from both the abyss and the sea. So there's no contradiction in that seeming discrepancy. Satan opened the pit of the abyss in the ninth chapter, and the events of the ninth chapter really are happening after the time that we're studying here in the 13th chapter, because this is a supplementary portion, as I hope I've made clear. But when the devil opened the abyss to its pit in the 9th chapter, the Moslem locust came forth from its smoke. Here, Satan opens the abyss and the beast comes out. And remember, this is prior to chapter 9. One of Satan's agents is the Eastern Roman, in the Eastern Roman world. The Muslim was from the Eastern Roman world, and the other that we're talking about here came from the Western Roman world. So when the pit is opened up twice, something in the east comes out one time and something in the west comes out another time. As the beast comes up out of the water, the horns, of course, are going to emerge first before the heads do. John saw the beast had 10 horns and 7 heads. This suggests identification with the beast of Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. We keep referring back to Daniel 7 because this all seems to be based on that. This is really just an expanded commentary on the 7th chapter of Daniel. On the dragon in chapter 12, the heads were mentioned before the horns. Here, at least in some manuscripts, the horns are mentioned before the heads. And the horns are now regal here. Here, there are diadem crowns placed on the horns. And I think that's an important thing, too, because it points to the time in history that we're talking about. We've got to be in the 4th century before that can happen. Whereas in chapter 12, they were seen wearing them on their head. So the crowns have shifted from the heads to the horns, and this suggests a time for the rise of the beast when the 10 kingdoms have been established. Remember in chapter 7, you've got those horns there already, and then this little horn comes up among them and from between them. Here we have the attributes of the leopard, the bear, and the lion, which to me just flatly proves the identification with the fourth beast of Daniel 7, because those are all mentioned back there. Here the fourth beast has characteristics of each of the previous three. Remember Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar in the 2nd chapter, Daniel 2:45, "The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and the interpretation is trustworthy." And here in Revelation 4, verse 1, "Come up here and I will show you what will take place after this." And it's using the same kind of symbolism to show that. We can see that there is an equivalency here from these scriptures. There is an equivalent specificity here. The comparable apocalyptic style of the visions of Daniel and the visions in Revelation. The equal claims being made, the equal promises being made, and the equivalent specificity in the fulfillment of the predictions as having been fulfilled by events, not just by ideas. Ultimately, there are only two kinds of kingdoms. There is the kingdom of God, and there's the kingdom of Satan. Just as Jesus operates through his followers, so Satan operates through his followers. Satan one time showed Jesus all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them in a moment of time and said, "All these things will I give thee if thou wilt fall down and worship me." That's in the 4th chapter of Matthew. As amplified in the 4th chapter of Luke, "All this power I will give you and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me," said Satan, "and to whomsoever I will, I give it." Luke 4, verses 5 and 6. The kingdoms of this world belong to Satan, and he works through them. He has the power, he has the authority to work through them. He's got the ability to do it, and he does it. The kingdoms of this earth operate on the philosophy of political expediency. Might makes right. It's only the Lord's kingdom that functions according to just the opposite principle, that right makes might. If God be for us, who can be against us? Be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. The kingdoms of earth pass away, away one by one, but the kingdom of heaven remains. And as the kingdoms of earth pass away one by one, they pass on their accumulated civilization to those kingdoms that come after them. Civilization doesn't die, it just migrates from one place to another. Each dying kingdom is perpetuated in spirit in the kingdoms that come after it. The nations that enslaved and persecuted the people of God were all used by Satan for that purpose as allowed by God. And as they passed from the scene one by one, each was perpetuated in spirit in the next. We know that from chapter 17 that the seven heads are seven mountains, and the mountain is a symbol of a kingdom, as it was put in Isaiah chapter 2. The mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the last days, and he's talking about the kingdom of the Lord. A mountain represents a kingdom in biblical prophecy. So we're told here about these seven kingdoms, these seven heads or mountains or kingdoms. What are the kingdoms of the earth that have enslaved the people of God? Well, we start out, first of all, obviously, with Egypt. It was Egypt that took God's people into captivity, and you know that story very well from the book of Exodus. These first enslaved the people of God. And then the Assyrians came in later and took 10 tribes captive. The Babylonians came in and took the kingdom of Judah captive. The Medes and the Persians came along, and the children of Israel were under their universal way. And then we know the story of Alexander the Great and the Grecian Empire. In chapter 17, verse 10, we're told that of the seven, five are fallen. And it was these first five. These were already fallen in John's day. They had already come and gone by 96 AD when the Apostle John was writing this. And we're told in, also in that same verse, Revelation 17, 10, that one now is in John's day. In 96 AD, one is. Which one was in John's day? It was obviously the pagan Roman Empire, which was persecuting people, including the Apostle John. That's how he was on the Isle of Patmos in the first place, from that persecution. So that one, number six, is in John's day. And then there was one in Revelation 17:10 that was said to be not yet come. In John's day, it had not yet come. And that was going to be this Christian Roman Empire that we've been talking about, this state church, this man-child. And it was said that in 17:10 that when this one came, it would continue for a short space, for a little while. It wasn't going to be real long term. It would just be there for a comparatively little while. And then there was going to be another one. Even though there were really only seven, there was an eighth that was of the seven, or of the seventh, and that was going to come later on. It was going to be unusual. It was going to be different from the others, and the eighth one would be papal Rome. When the papacy got going, then it would be an eighth one. The eighth is of the seven, and we're told, and goeth to perdition. So those are the eight, and when we get to chapter 17, we don't even have to go back and talk about those because we've already seen them here in chapter 13, but we can't really talk about chapter 13 without unfolding that, I don't think. The fierce powers of the Roman beast include the speed to kill of the Greek leopard, the trampling feet of the Persian bear, and the ravenous mouth of the Babylonian lion. It includes all of these together in this one empire, and I think that's why those figures are all included. Just ties it back to Daniel 7 so closely that I don't see how anybody could argue against that. Rome, literally, at this time, was on seven hills. There are the names of the seven hills on the screen if you happen to be interested in those. The Aventine, Capitoline, Palatine, Esquiline, Caelian, Quirinal, and Viminal were the names of the city of Rome that literally, at that time, sat on the seven hills. And so that symbolism of the literal is used here to talk about these seven kingdoms in a symbolic manner. The beast from the sea had seven heads, but it also had 10 horns. Now, a horn is a power, as we've said before, like the horn on a steer or an ox or a bull manifests its power through its horns. I believe these 10 horns are the same as the 10 toes on the image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2:42. And I'll just put those up there quickly for you. These are the 10 tribes or the 10 toes or the 10 horns. These were the tribes of Europe that later on became the nations of Europe as we know them today. But these were the tribes from that time. The Huns, the Ostrogoths. Ostrogoths just means Eastern Goths. Visigoths means Western Goths. The Franks, the Alans, the Vandals, the Sueves and the Alans together, the Burgundians, the Heruli and Rugians, the Italians, the Anglos and the Saxons, and the Lombards. 10. The round number 10 is not absolute. When we have round numbers used in symbolic terminology, it doesn't always mean precisely that number specifically. Now, when we have numbers that aren't round used, I think it does refer to something very specific, like 1260. That's not a round number. But 10 is a round number, 100 is a round number, 1,000 is a round number, and when we get to chapter 20, we need to remember that 1,000 is a round number that's not necessarily used to convey statistical information. And I think 10 is the same way. It's not absolute, but it's average. It's an appropriate symbol for these nations, which more often than not averaged 10 with the vicissitudes of time. Sometimes there were 9, sometimes there were 11, but usually there were about 10. So I think that's the way it's used here. 10 is the medium of all the oscillations through the years. Interestingly also, Isaac Newton, when he commented on this, and by the way, Isaac Newton wrote far more about the Bible than he did about science, even though he's one of the greatest scientists who has ever lived and very famous for discovering the law of gravity and his laws of motion and so forth. He wrote lots, thousands of pages about his researches into the Bible. And he pointed out on this that the number 10 might be justified here as the number of kingdoms at the time that the horns are introduced into history. And I can't argue with that. The apostles were sometimes called the 12, as you know, sometimes just referred to as the 12, even when for a while there were only 11 because Judas had already died, but still you could arguably make the case that they were referred to as the 12. You can check out John 20, verse 24 on that, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5 on that, and see what you think of that argument. I think it makes sense to at least take a look at that. These horns were crowned with the diadem, the official crown of the Roman emperor since Diocletian. As these barbarian kingdoms arose during the final era of the old Roman Empire, they showed their allegiance to Rome by stamping their coinage with the image of the emperor wearing the diadem. And then later, with the fall of the empire and the empowerment of the Roman bishop, the barbarian kings resorted to printing their own images on the coins, crowned with the Roman imperial diadem. That's one of the ways that they inserted their own independent authority. And then, see, the Bishop of Rome went out and he took over all those countries and had an empire from which to function. But the 10 crowns that are on these 10 tribes, the crowns of Europe as they became, I'll just list them here. These 10, this is the best we can do to come up with the fullness of the number 10. At different points in time, you would have different nations, one out and another one in and so forth. But this over time would be the best we can do to give a panoramic view of what the 10 nations of Europe have been through the years. Very familiar names. And the numbers in parentheses are the years in which they broke away from the temporal power of the papacy. And there's a story behind each one of these. We talked last night, I think it was last night, about Henry VIII in 1534. England was the first one out. A tenth part of the city fell in chapter 11. And there's a equivalent story for every one of these, but we're not going to take the time to tell all of that. In verse 2, the dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. So the dragon now has been functioning through paganism. That's not viable anymore. Tried to bring it back. It didn't work. So the dragon gives the beast his power, and throne and great authority. The letter to Pergamum had said that Satan's seat was located in that city, in the city of Pergamum, perhaps referring to the imperial cult center temple that was at Pergamum, the ruins of which can still be seen today at the ancient site of Pergamum, where Christians were commanded to sacrifice to the Roman emperor as if he was a god. Everybody had to sacrifice a little pinch of incense and just say that the Caesar was a god. In chapter 16, we'll see that the fifth bowl is poured out on the throne of the beast, which was the city of Rome. The dragon is Satan operating through the pagan Roman government, the sixth head. And now Satan is going to operate through the so-called Christian Roman government, the seventh head. But chapter 17:10, remember, said that when this seventh kingdom comes, it will only continue a short space, only a little while. So in verse 3, we come to the deadly wound. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. Paul said, 2 Thessalonians 2, 7 and 8, that he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way, and then shall that wicked be revealed. And that's where we've come to here. The imperial Christian Roman Empire fell with a deadly wound in 476 AD. We have seen the forced abdication of the last emperor of the Western Roman Empire. His name was Romulus Augustulus. He had only started reigning in 475, and he's put out in 476 by the Heruli king Odoacer, who became the first barbarian king of Italy. So that is the deadly wound to the so-called Christian Roman Empire. We saw these barbarian invasions in chapter 8. Under the fourth trumpet, we saw this very thing happening. But the Roman Empire is now going to be reconstituted when the deadly wound was healed. This resurrected head is referred to in chapter 17, verse 11, as an eighth king or kingdom. There are only seven heads, and yet here is an eighth. But the eighth is of a different makeup. It is of the seven, and it goeth into perdition. As long as the imperial power was in place, there was no room for the development of the Roman bishop, the way he was going to develop later. When the imperial power was removed, the man of sin stepped into that vacuum of power. You know how nature abhors a vacuum. Something or somebody will always step into it. And that simple bishop of Rome, the bishop of Rome who was not even mentioned in the letters of Ignatius. Ignatius wrote, apparently, in the early 2nd century, and he mentioned the bishops of several congregations, but he never even mentioned the bishop of Rome when he talked about other bishops. That simple bishop of Rome would be viewed as the vicar of Christ on the earth. That simple bishop of Rome would overcome common sense and moral sense of those who claim to be the church and should... All these people would prostrate themselves before him for so many centuries. It just shows that old serpent's power to delude and to deceive the eyes of men, to blind people's eyes. Under papal headship, Rome revived as with a second birth because the deadly wound was healed. It revived as with a second birth. The supreme pontiff was the substitute of the emperor. Rome being the head of the world, the Church of Rome was considered to be the head of all the churches. And the reason this was possible is that Rome was viewed as the see of Peter. Peter was viewed as the chief apostle on whom the church was built as they spun the scriptures. They took Matthew 16:16 and spun it in this direction. Peter received the power of binding and loosing. Rome was the scene of his martyrdom. Rome was where Peter was buried. And Rome was the place where he still lived and exercised judgment in his successors at Rome, as they told the story. The eighth head perpetuates the same spirit as all these other heads had. The authority of Satan is given to it, but it claims to be the kingdom of God, ruled by the vicar of Christ, with all authority in heaven, earth, and hell. The beast that was and is not and yet is, chapter 17, verse 8, is a cryptic allusion to that fatal wound of the seventh head and the eighth that would come up as the healing of that deadly wound. This is another manifestation of the Roman government. We saw three forms of it: pagan, so-called Christian, and then papal. This is a later stage in the development of the Roman Empire. His deadly wound was healed, and we're told all the world wondered after the beast. Satan now has a new agency to carry on his anti-Christian war. And it can be very, very difficult for people to penetrate this disguise and to recognize the Lord's enemy under an apparently Christian covering. The world thinks this is Christianity. When many, many people all around us in the world think of Christianity, they think of this very institution. They think of this very system. But attention has to be paid to detail. The beast from the sea is a reincarnation of the dragon, a reincarnation of the Roman Empire, the papal Roman Christendom. Both have seven heads and ten horns. Both are agents of Satan. The dragon represents pagan Rome as animated by Satan, and the beast represents the combination of church and state. There was a temporary demise. The deadly wound was healed with the rise of the eighth head, or revived seventh. The papal Roman Empire begins to come into full bloom. Here's what Edward Gibbon had to say, just very briefly, about this. Like Thebes, Babylon, or Carthage, the name of Rome might have been erased from the earth if the city had not been animated by a vital principle. What was that vital principle? which again restored her to honor and dominion. What was the vital principle? According to Gibbon, the vital principle was the tradition that a Jewish tent maker and a fisherman had formerly been executed at Rome, and after 500 years, their genuine or fictitious relics were adored as the palladium of Christian Rome, and their shrines resorted to from east and west. People came from all over the world to see pieces of Peter and Paul's bodies and things that had to do with them. Relics became a big business, and Rome just naturally just became the center of all of this. The beast is characterized by his proud words, by his blasphemies. Daniel chapter 7, verse 8 and verse 20 talks about the little horn speaking boastfully. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4 says that he exalts himself over everything that is called God or that is worshipped. The dragon gave authority to the beast. The beast was given power to make war against the saints. Verse 7. And as in the days of Job, God permits Satan and his agents to wage this war, but only within the boundaries of God's providence and greater purpose. Sometimes there seems to be a lot of latitude in God's permissive providence. The authority of the beast to wage war was going to last for 42 months. This is the same period of time that the holy city was to be trampled down, as we saw in chapter 11. It's the same period of time that the two witnesses were to prophesy, as we saw in chapter 11. Same period of time that the woman was to be nursed in the wilderness, as we saw in chapter 12. And it's all the same 42 months, all the same 3.5 symbolic years, all the same 1,260 years, that all these things are happening during that period of time and in concert with one another. The description of this war is the apocalyptic commentary. The war of the little horn of the fourth beast is described way back in Daniel 7 and just amplified here. In Daniel, he's distinguished by his boastful speaking against the Most High and the fact that he tries to change times and laws. The King James Bible said he shall think to change times and laws. Paul calls this horn the man of lawlessness or the man of sin. Daniel chapter, Revelation, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Paul calls this a rebellion, an apostasy, a falling away, an apostasia, the spirit of disobedience to God, the mystery of iniquity. Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, the symbols usually refer to national powers rather than just individuals. We're not talking about individuals of the papacy here either. We're talking about the papacy as a system. The kings are named as founders and representatives of the kingdoms and the empires that are under discussion. Nebuchadnezzar, for instance, was said to be the head of gold, but there were other Babylonian kings after Nebuchadnezzar, and the head of gold really included them as well, a multiplicity of rulers. The ten horns represent kingdoms rather than individual kings. In Daniel 8, verse 20 and 21, kings are named and kingdoms are meant. The king represents the kingdom, and the kingdom is concentrated in its king. With the exception of a common reverence for the Roman See, these ten powers of Europe that we're talking about really didn't have any point of union. They were united only by their mutual allegiance to this burgeoning system. This conjunction of secular and spiritual power was essential to the popes in their development through the years. The little horn in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8, is described as arising from among the other horns. The ten horns must represent the Roman kingdoms which were already in place contemporaneously with the eighth head. And this fits perfectly with the known facts of history. The scriptures and history come together here, hand in glove, dovetailing harmoniously and beautifully. In verse 7 here, the beast was given authority over every tribe and every people and language and nation. This is the Roman Empire with its ten kingdoms. The Roman world is what we're talking about here. Caesar Augustus, Luke 2:1, made a decree that all the world should be taxed. It's talking about the Roman world. Oikumenoke, the Roman world. We don't need to insist on global universality here. We're talking about just the Roman world. The first readers of the book of Revelation surely were aware that 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4, talked about the man of lawlessness setting himself up in the temple of God and making himself an object of worship, and could fit this with what was happening. After the Roman destruction of the Jerusalem temple in 70 A.D., there was only one temple left that was familiar to the readers of the Revelation, one place left that could be called the sanctuary of God, and that was the church of Jesus Christ, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3, 16. So the original readers had sufficient information to infer from Scripture that the coming Antichrist was going to conduct his war from within the sanctuary of the church, as viewed by man. This conclusion should have been implicit in the harlot motif in Revelation 17, because the Old Testament prophets had talked about that harlot motif on and on and on. The bride and bridegroom harlot theme was so extensively covered in the Old Testament, nobody could have missed it, relative to the apostasy of Israel. The 16th chapter of the book of Ezekiel alone would have been enough to ram that point home. The book of Hosea alone would have been enough to make that point. Who worships the beast? Those whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. They do not include those who were sealed in chapter 7 and who were seen by John proleptically standing before the throne of God, a great multitude that nobody could count. These appear again in chapter 14 singing the song of redemption. Many who died in this war were singing hymns of praise when they died. This stresses the inevitability of persecution and death for the faithful, and it may be that the destiny of some of us who are sitting here tonight will be to die for our faith in the Lord. That could very easily happen again. There are indications in chapter 20 that there might be a time like that coming. So what these people experienced was deadly serious to them, and we may face that same type of thing again. I'm sorry we've run out of time. It seems like we always run out at an awkward spot, but we'll conclude for this evening. You're very good to come, and